Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Once Upon a Time at the Oscars. Hey everyone, and welcome to Once Upon a Time at the Oscars.
The show that takes you through every Best Picture nominee from 1927 to today.
I'm your host, Kyle.
And I'm prisoner 48624.
Oh, snap. Is that a Les Mis reference?
No, it's actually a reference to what we're going to be talking about today.
What a plot twist. It feels like it's been forever since we recorded.
2 weeks?
Yeah, which isn't that long, but we've gotten into such a groove that, I don't know, when we were prepping for today, I was like, do I remember the ancient art of podcasting?
Well, I think it's because it's probably the closest we've come to the episode releasing and recording the episode.
Right.
And even then, it's roughly about a month out.
Yeah, which is, we're doing good.
But it is worth mentioning that we do record these a little bit in advance, but we do keep track of when these are going to come out. So I would just like to say, Merry Christmas, Kyle.
Oh my goodness.
Did you have a good Christmas?
Yeah, I think. Christmas was what, like 2 days ago?
It was yesterday.
Oh, ho, ho, ho. Yeah, no. So Merry Christmas, everyone. I hope it was great for all of you if you celebrate. Looking forward to the new year. Mm-hmm. Looking forward to the end of season one.
Yeah.
Next Wednesday will be the end of season one with our ceremony episode. And I don't know. Hopefully you've been enjoying the podcast.
I think you have. I think based on the reception that we've received, it's fun to hear that other people also find the enjoyment out of history with this and seeing the trends, seeing where things started. You talk a lot about how I like to go see movies in theaters, and just this past week I did that. I think later today will actually be my fourth time in theaters in less than a week. So I'm living a good life, man.
Yeah.
I'm living a good life. So it's always fun to watch those movies, like newer movies, and kind of see like where we stemmed from. So I'm excited to talk today because I know that this is one we've done our westerns, we've done our musicals, we've done our crime dramas. This is kind of something we haven't really done before, that is done very many times in history, but isn't like, I think if you ask someone their favorite genre, this isn't really where they start. No. I think people have a lot of affinity for this, but this is kind of like for the real heads. You know, a lot of people you talk to will be like, oh, I love Assault on Precinct 13, or I love like Brawl in Cell Block 99. There's a lot of movies that can cover something like this, but it's really the first time we've covered this idea of a genre.
Yeah, it's kind of a micro genre in a way.
A little, yeah.
Which is so funny because like if you go to IMDb and you look at the 100 greatest movies of all time, I'm pretty sure this is still number one. Not this movie, but this genre.
Sure.
With the Shawshank Redemption.
Yes.
And it's just wild that it's not a more talked about in the mainstream as a genre, a popular genre.
Well, I think it's the same thing but it's a similar thing as westerns, where I think people just kind of see one western, they're going to like westerns. And they see one, you know, prison break movie, and they're like, oh, I don't really like prison break movies. And, like, that's just not correct. Like, you may have seen Assault on Precinct 13 or, you know, something like, I'm trying to think of the one with James Dean.
Oh, it's one of three movies. Rebel Without a Cause, Giant, or...
It's Rebel Without a Cause.
Gotcha.
So Rebel Without a Cause, the idea is just, like, you haven't seen all of these. And it's really cool to see, like, the blueprint kind of exist.
Yeah.
And, of course, what we're talking about today is 1930s The Big House.
Yes.
This will be our final movie of the 1930s Oscar ceremony year.
This was one covered on the original run of the show.
Yep.
And I was really excited to revisit. This is a pretty cool one.
Yeah.
I like that we're talking about these kind of micro genres like you talked about. Yeah, let's get right into it.
Okay.
So, The Big House from 1930, this is an MGM production, which I want to make like a spreadsheet of all the Best Picture nominees and how many nominations each studio has received over time. I'd love to build some kind of system to keep track of that.
Well, the past 2 years alone, MGM has at least three.
which is wild.
Right? Broadway Melody, Hollywood Review of 1929, and The Big House.
Yeah, which kind of makes sense when you think about who the original founder of the Academy was, with Louis B. Mayer, MGM Studios, Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer. Maybe he's pulling for himself.
I imagine he is.
Probably.
But it didn't quite go his way this year.
No, it didn't.
We'll say that.
Spoiler alert. This was directed by George W. Hill. It starred Chester Morris, returning fan favorite.
Mm-hmm.
He played John Morgan. We saw him in The Divorcee earlier this year, right? That was
correct.
This year?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Wallace Beery as Machine Gun Butch. Robert Montgomery. Again, we saw him in The Divorcee. And Lewis Stone as Warden James Adams.
So The Big House was nominated for 4 Academy Award nominations. Best Writing Achievement for Frances Marion. Best Sound as well. Recording. That's sound recording, I think.
Sound recording.
Okay, correct, yeah. That's weird. There's like a comma in here. I was very concerned what that means. So Best Sound Recording for Douglas Shearer. Nominated for Best Actor for Wallace Beery. And was also nominated for, the whole reason we're talking today, Best Picture.
Nice. Some cool things in the nominations, or the nominees rather, right off the bat. Sound recording, we talked about Douglas Shearer for The Divorcee,
mm-hmm.
Norma Shearer's brother.
Right.
And he was basically head of sound at MGM. So you pop in any MGM movie, most any MGM film from this era, you're going to see his name pop up.
Hmm.
And he was taking home tons of, at least nominations, but he also won tons of awards for the sound recording category. Just a huge contributor to the early sound films in general. It's pretty cool.
I mean, it's interesting because the time that it comes out, we're only in the second year where this is really a category that can be included.
Yeah.
So it's interesting because I think now we have sound editing and sound design. So the ability to differentiate those is still something I battle with every day of like, you know, what exactly is editing, what's recording. So for this time, it's interesting because it does feel a little bit like we have to put this award in there because now we're doing sound, but have they really mastered what that looks like yet?
Right.
Interesting to hear a little bit of, you know, when you're watching The Big House, you're not really thinking too much about sound, right? The sound isn't necessarily something that stands out to you as like, oh, I really like the editing they did with this. For me, I noticed that a lot more with All Quiet on the Western Front, just because there's a lot more to be edited in terms of like the gunshots and everything. And there's a scene in The Big House that can probably lend itself mostly to excellence in sound recording, but wasn't something that stood out to me with this movie specifically. So it feels a little bit more of its time.
Very interesting. I think this movie utilizes sound in really unique ways.
Hmm.
If we flashback to Alibi. At the beginning of that movie opens with them being in prison and all of that, and there's a lot of like banging on the cell blocks and things that we praised.
Yeah.
There's quite a bit of that in this movie as well.
Hmm.
I don't know if it's used in a way that we found as artistically, but I think it adds kind of to the atmosphere of the movie in a big way.
Interesting. That makes more sense because to me, if anything stood out in terms of, and it's very smart that you brought up Alibi because this does feel almost a companion piece to Alibi, not just in subject matter, but also we talked a lot about the Germanist expression.
Yeah.
In that. And there's a couple shots, 2 to 3 specifically, of this that are very wide, mm-hmm. of people walking into the prison. And it's very intimidating. It's very like they use the space and it's very like a very large room.
Yeah.
Feels very much like that opening of Alibi that we talked about. So for me, I was seeing more of the visual side.
Right.
And then the performances obviously are, you know, they go a long way. They carry this movie. So maybe you're right that it is something that lends itself more to like the overall feel than it is just like one specific thing that stands out. But I was paying way more attention to the visuals and the set design.
Yeah.
And the shots they got because of it.
And I don't blame you. The beginning of this movie, when we're pulling up to the prison, it's like the largest scale of like a building or a set, even if it is like a matte painting. I believe that's what the prison is.
Yes.
And it's, like you said, very imposing, very intimidating, and probably the biggest, most obvious example that we've covered on the show so far. But I don't blame you for being just focused on the visuals after that opening
right
look.
So, and also, just to clarify things, just in case that there's a bad recording that popped up, watched on Tubi. My understanding is that this was only available on Tubi. I didn't find it on YouTube. So my understanding, there shouldn't be any problem with that. We're out of the silent film era, so.
Yeah, I don't think we have any worry of running into that for a little while.
We shouldn't, no.
We shouldn't.
So let's get into the plot a little bit here.
Yeah.
So we're introduced to Kent, portrayed by Robert Montgomery, as entering this prison, and he's there for manslaughter. We find out that this is because he was a drunk driver who killed a man specifically, and he's been sentenced to 10 years. I want to go ahead and stop real quick. In 2025, how did this sound to you, the idea of 10 years for manslaughter?
It's, I mean, this is something that rubs me the wrong way today. I worked at the tag office. Peek behind the curtain, and there was stuff like this that would pop up in real life where I'm like, oh, this person's trying to get their tag. They killed someone last year. Like, this is rough. I hate it. So, yeah, to get real about it, this sucks.
Yeah, no, this
not
sucks.
Not a fan.
It kind of took me out of the movie immediately when they're like, oh, you killed the man, huh? Like, yeah. By manslaughter, you ran him over? Yeah. 10 years? It's like, huh?
Yeah.
Excuse me? 10 years?
Also, killed the man? If you're really good, it'll be less.
Yeah, but if you're really nice to everyone, we'll get you out of here sooner.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, it's not really ever talked about, mostly if it was like an accident or what, and the character work comes out of Kent later that can kind of muddy the waters a little bit. Mm. But overall, not the best start to a movie of, you know, hey, here's how prisons work. But
hasn't changed much.
Hasn't changed much. And you know what? Factual. We'll give it that.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, factual. So we're introduced to this prison that he's joining, and we hear from the warden that he's going to be rooming with two other people, because right now it's spaced for about 1,800 people, but they have about 3,000 prisoners. So we're almost doubling up our space.
Isn't that crazy?
And I think that's kind of half of this movie, is that one half of it is talking about Kent and Morgan and my guy Machine Gun. But MGK in this movie. But the other half of it, too, is social commentary on, like, you know, even back in the 1930s, it was a problem that prisons were not fully staffed. And we were, like, doubling up our numbers, if not more.
It's wild.
Crazy. So I don't think this movie takes, like, a heavy stance on it that by the end you're like, yeah, here's the problem with it. But it is something that it mentions, and I kind of thought that was refreshing.
Yeah.
So very cool. But because of this overstaffing issue, Kent is forced to room with two other individuals. Morgan, who you mentioned is played by Chester Morris, and Machine Gun Butch, played by Wallace Beery. So Wallace Beery as Machine Gun Butch is the first person that we meet of the two. He's standing there and has a conversation. And I swear to God, if I have to hear him say, "I'm only kidding," one more time,
yeah,
I lost my mind. Because this man is only kidding, ever. Every 5 seconds, just, "I'm only kidding." Literally at one point has a knife and, like, almost kills someone. He's like, "I'm only kidding." Like, you almost killed that guy. What do you mean you're only kidding? Anyways, it's like his catchphrase. But he did say it plenty of times. And this scene, I almost went back and watched, but I kind of wanted to talk to you about it instead. It's a very tight cell, right? Very tight cell. I actually love the camera work in it because they kind of found one place the camera could be and kept it there. And it's three bunk beds on top of each other. And Machine Gun sleeps in the bottom. And he tells Kent that he can sleep on the top shelf. And you're like, cool, that leaves the metal shelf that's currently empty. And then the camera cuts and Morgan has been sleeping there. Did you catch that? Or did I miss Morgan in that first shot? Because it looks empty. And then all of a sudden, there's just a body laying there.
No, I didn't notice.
Okay, we'll have to go back and check. But that was one that, to me, was like, huh?
You think they, like, edited a magic trick? Like,
well, I thought they were like...
trip to the mooning it?
I think, legitimately, that it may have been too hot in that room, so they tried to, like, limit how many people were in that room at the same time. So they're like, well, he doesn't need to be in the bed, so now just put him in the bed.
Interesting.
But with that said, there's plenty of scenes where the three of them are in there, but they all have, like, dialogue, so I wasn't sure if it's like, well, you're technically asleep at this time, so maybe we don't need to put you in there.
Huh.
Maybe we can have you, like, put blankets on it, and, like, that's like you're turned over or something.
Yeah, yeah.
But then the camera cuts, and it's just a whole man just, like, laying on the bed, and you're like, where'd you come from?
That's so interesting.
There's a very real possibility he was laying in the corner and then, like, shifted, but you didn't see him shift, so it's weird. Anyways, point is, we then meet Morgan, and Morgan seems a little more level-headed than a man named Machine Gun. So... Morgan convinces Machine Gun to give back the cigarettes that he stole from Kent. And this is initiation has begun. We're already trying to bully the new kid and see how far we can get. And it's worth noting that Kent does seem very fearful, right? This is not a criminal mastermind who has found his way in prison again and is now plotting a way to get out. He seems very like, I guess this is what my life is and I got to figure this out.
Yeah.
Seems very sympathetic in that sense too, a real hero of the story, which is why the introduction of Machine Gun and Morgan then kind of immediately seems the villains of the story have entered, right?
Yeah, at least Machine Gun Butch.
Correct. Morgan seems to be kind of playing the anti-hero a little bit of like, which way is he really leaning? Mm-hmm. Depends on the day. But it's worth noting that after he has Machine Gun give back the cigarettes to Kent, that he actually does take the cigarettes back from him and then smokes and then puts the cigarettes back. So he's still kind of like making sure the right thing is done, but taking what he needs at the same time.
Yeah, yeah.
So a little Robin Hood here and there.
Kent's paid his dues for Morgan protecting him.
I think it's also worth noting that Machine Gun knocks out Kent and then puts him to bed.
So Butch is an aggressive dude.
Yeah, he is.
Throughout the entire movie, you're hearing him. He'll talk about women and be like, oh, my old lady's back home. But when I get out of here, I might kill her.
Yeah.
Like, it's brutal.
I do think, you know how sometimes you'll be like looking outside and like see something while you're watching a movie and then you'll hear something that kind of snaps you right back to it?
Yeah.
Machine Gun has a line where he's like, yeah, that picture that Kent showed us of his sister looked a lot like this girl that I knew. Boy, I shouldn't have given her ant poison.
Yes.
Like, what was that? One more time?
He's like, he deserves to be in prison, clearly.
Sure. Uh-huh.
He's a bad guy. He's very, probably the worst person that Kent could have got placed in a cell with. I think Wallace Beery is fantastic in this role.
Oh, yeah. Nominated for a reason.
So good. He's scary. He's rough. He goes through all of these really terrifying lines of dialogue where he's talking about all of these women he's done awful things to. But then he has these moments where he'll get a letter from a doctor or a friend or someone basically saying, hey, your mother's passed away. And he has these very, very heartfelt moments where you're really feeling for him. And Wallace Beery manages to play these two sides. Not even two sides, because he's still very much Butch. He's just sad Butch. And he does it so well.
He does. Honestly, there was a time when, maybe I just got Wolheim on the brain, but there was a time where I actually thought that this was, you know, another trifecta of my guy Lewis Wolheim.
Yeah.
From The Racket and All Quiet on the Western Front, also starring in this. Because the way he's chewing scenery is a very much like Wolheim type performance that we've seen. But no, you're right. It is specifically Wallace Beery, and he is so good.
Yeah.
He's playing that range very well. And although it does bother me at times with, like, you know, how much he's... I think he throws food at a couple... He calls them screws, but officers.
Yes.
He throws food at them and starts, like, an actual riot of people throwing food. And then says, I was only kidding. And I was like, come on, man. Like, you can't throw food at an officer and be like, just joshing.
Yeah.
But he plays that very well to where you kind of believe, like, he has the mental capacity to kind of not realize what he's doing in the moment, but
yes,
then try and dial it back on the back end. So I really liked the character work from him. Mm-hmm. Nominated for a reason. I'll go ahead and say one thing I think this movie doesn't have going for it is that the character work isn't really fully established up front. There are times where you're kind of like unsure of why people are doing what they're doing. Mm. Even going back and reviewing or researching for this, the way that Morgan is described is not the way that I picked up on Morgan from the very beginning. Morgan seemed more like an intimidating figure and that he wasn't looking out for the frightened and like helping people who needed it in the prison. Mm. But that's how he's described later on. And that doesn't seem like the Morgan we're introduced to. And maybe that's intentional. But to me, there's a midpoint moment that we'll get to here in a little bit that just felt kind of out of left field because that's not who we were introduced to.
Yeah.
So I think that sometimes, specifically not Machine Gun. I think Machine Gun is exactly how he's introduced and then carries that on forward. But I think Kent and Morgan have a little bit of like a definition issue.
Yeah, I think that kind of is there to serve a purpose later on.
Sure.
When their true characters are revealed.
Sure.
Kent's introduced is just scared. He's terrified. He doesn't want to be there. He wants to get out as soon as possible. He's just trying to do whatever he can to not get in like people like Butch's path. I think that Morgan, he's close to getting out.
That's true.
So I think he's on his best behavior. He's trying real hard to make sure nothing happens that prevents him from getting out. And it's when something does happen that kind of takes away that end goal for him that he flips back to, oh, this is why he's here in the first place. You almost have to be reminded, like, okay, these are criminals. One way or the other, they did something that landed them here.
Mm-hmm.
Now I see why Morgan is behaving the way he is.
Got it. Yeah, I think that just kept me from like fully connecting with the story so much and kind of unsure of what was happening. Now, the event in question is that during a scene where they're eating in the lunchroom, Machine Gun starts a riot because he doesn't want to eat this food anymore, hates the smell of rotten fish. So he starts a food fight. And when he starts that food fight, it's clear that he's about to get detained. So he actually passes down his knife. So when he gets frisked, no one feels anything. And it gets passed down to Kent. So Kent is now the sole owner of this knife and responsible for it. And because of his actions, Machine Gun is sent to solitary, where he has to sit, I think, for a month in silence with just food and, or bread and water. So when this happens, they go back to their cell. And Kent then takes the time to introduce to, or I'm sorry, Morgan takes the time to introduce to Kent, hey, I'm on parole. I'm out of parole. I'm about to get out of here. All I got to do is just make sure I pass this, like, you know, frisk, and we're good to go.
Yeah.
And then they get a random room inspection. And it's at this time that Kent then takes it upon himself to place this knife that belongs to Machine Gun and to put it on, I almost said Montgomery, Morgan's jacket.
Mm-hmm.
Why do you think he did this?
Just so he didn't get caught with a knife. He cares only about himself. He's worried about anything bad that could happen to him. He doesn't want to get thrown into solitary. That's all it is. I don't think he has any malice towards Morgan or anybody else. Maybe eventually Butch, but he really is just looking out for himself.
So that makes more sense. And to me, my natural thought would be, if I'm going to plan it on anybody, I just met this new guy, right? Machine Gun was just kicked out of our room. There's a third guy who doesn't even speak English in here. Like, it feels a lot easier for him to kind of like plant that on him than on
Morgan.
Than on Morgan, who's going to be here. Like, it just doesn't feel thought out, because like now Morgan is taken, this is taken away from him. Now he can't be free. He's going into solitary for 30 days. And when he gets out, what's going to happen?
Yeah. I think he's so scared that he just does not think.
That was my question for you, was whether it was intentional or not. Like, obviously it was intentional that he ditched the knife, but this was right after Morgan was saying, remember his name that time, that Morgan was saying how he was almost out.
Yeah.
And that almost feels vindictive. Like, it feels intentional that, hey, you're almost out of here? I don't think so. But it's not a good idea. So if anything, just put the knife like on that third guy, not helpful in this sense. And, you know, still an innocent man is charged for something.
Yeah.
But just didn't make a ton of sense to me. Now, obviously, pretty quickly, when this is found, Morgan knows, okay, Kent, this guy just walked in here. Why would he do that to me?
Mm-hmm.
You did this to me, and I'm going to make you pay for this. And then there's a great scene where he's being kicked into the solitary confinement and has a very long conversation with a Machine Gun. Yeah. I guess conversation's one word for it. Another one is when they're yelling at each other, and then I think it's Morgan who actually starts singing like a song.
Yeah.
Great scene. It's just so funny to hear like Machine Gun mad yelling over someone singing. But obviously this is terrible for both of them. Machine Gun even mentions at the end of the 30 days, he hasn't heard from Morgan in like a week. So he might be face down, I think is what he says.
Yeah.
And they find him in there and he is incapacitated. Morgan is out of it. So they bring a gurney to take him out. And as Butch is checking on him, actually realizes he's playing me a little bit and he's pretending to be dead. And he then uses his opportunity to sneak out of the prison by taking the place of a cadaver and getting taken out of the prison. And he actually escapes. And what does he do when he escapes, Kyle?
He goes to meet Kent's sister, Anne Marlowe. She works at a bookstore. And this is such an interesting moment because I don't know if his intention is to do something bad as kind of revenge against Kent.
Well, he says, like, I'll get you for this. So, and he had pointed out the picture of his sister.
Right.
He had said, like, you know, he had a clear infatuation, and Machine Gun said, you know, a little more than that. But
yeah,
you could tell that Morgan kind of imprinted on this picture a little bit.
Yes. But I still find it interesting. Was his point to go track her down and, like, woo her? To be like, ha ha, check it out, Kent. me and your sister are together now? Or was he going to like commit violence against her?
I think this is where my issue with the movie continues, because there's like character definition that you can't really read. And I don't know if it's like the way that they're written, the way that certain scenes play, and you can't really get to understand them. But obviously the idea of him escaping from prison, mm-hmm. he's finally free. He can do whatever he wants. But this feels very vindictive. This feels very much, well, you did this to me, so now I'm going to do this to you, right?
Yeah.
It's not painted in a way of like, I've seen this beautiful girl and now I need to find her. It's very much like a Kent will pay for what he did. So yeah. It feels very much in the former of what you meant with like, I'm going to get back to you now. And I'm not going to do anything to harm your sister, but like, I am going to be involved with your sister and that's going to tear you up inside.
Right. I think this is kind of an underlying theme in the movie to me must be that these are criminals.
Yes.
And you have to remind yourself of that. So when they escape and you're like, cool, you're free. Go run. Go be free. These are criminals. He is going to do the revenge thing. He's going to do something that makes absolutely zero sense in this moment because he is a criminal.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if that's just kind of an understanding of, I don't, maybe that's how criminals and prisoners and things were viewed in the 30s. You know, I don't know what that is, or if they're just like, this will make a good story.
Right.
But he shows up, he meets Anne Marlowe, and it is the speed at which they kind of move.
Insane.
That really kind of takes me out of it more than anything up to this point.
Yeah. Well, I mean, like one of the first things that he says is like, hi, my name is, and she's like, I know.
Yeah.
She's like, I remember. I saw you at the prison. And it's worth mentioning earlier on that she goes to visit her brother, and he is, Morgan is there. Mm-hmm. So it is logical that she saw him, but just to immediately see him be like, oh, hey, you're in prison, right? With my yeah. brother, like just a few weeks ago. Well, months ago at this point. But she recognizes him pretty quickly. And then this kind of like spawns the rom-com element of this movie.
Yeah.
Where now it's kind of like any advantage that he has on her is completely out in the open. So now they're just talking and they're kind of like, hey, this rocks. Like we get along very well. She gets over the whole like prison thing pretty quickly.
Yeah.
And they just catch up and he's like, well, hey, I'm going to get out of your hair. And she's like, you should come see me whenever you want. He's like, I don't want to do that. And she's like, no, you should.
Yeah.
So it's just a very much like, you know, he feels like he's kind of done his part and he can walk away, but she invites him back to see her again. And we don't have to get fully into it, but he does try to live a different life and finds himself back in prison. He's found.
How much time do you think was spent with Anne?
A day? 2 days?
Like, you actually think that's how much time was spent, or that's what you deduced from what the movie showed you?
Probably both, but I was thinking more from what it showed me.
Yeah, I feel like I have to tell myself, okay, and they spent 2 months together.
Yeah, yeah.
Otherwise, it just doesn't make sense.
There's actually a pretty helpful calendar trick that's on screen.
Yeah.
Specifically shown when Kent first arrives to prison to kind of show how long it's been once we next see him. And then when Morgan and Machine Gun are sent to Solitary, there's another one to show like, hey, it's been a month since this happened. I kind of think we could have used something like that for this. Not so much in like how long has he been spending with his sister, but more now he's coming back to prison. How long has it been?
Yes.
Right?
Something.
Not really established.
I think the moment he's with Anne is the worst part of the movie.
I agree.
I think their scene together in the bookstore could have been very tense because you don't know what he's there for mm-hmm. in that moment. But the way it goes from a, uh-oh, he's there. Oh, hang on. Oh, no, they like each other.
They're having a great time.
She's questioning it. Nope, they love each other.
Yeah.
And it happens so quick. And then it feels like the next day, he gets picked up by the cops immediately. And you're like, what happened?
Yeah, it's, I don't understand. I think I told you up front, there's a character definition problem here that across the board, it just doesn't really feel like the characters are fully fleshed out. It feels like as the scene continues, the characters do what the story needs them to. And it doesn't really feel super fleshed out for me.
Yeah.
I think that's pretty clear throughout the movie.
I have a note here from my original run that says, if this movie was made today, it would be 2 hours and 45 minutes, and an hour and a half would be Morgan living his life with Anne.
Yeah.
Way to go, past Kyle.
You nailed it.
That's, I like
you. That would have been it. That would have been it. Because there needs to be something more.
Yeah.
Worth mentioning, the movie does clock in at about an hour and 27 minutes, so it's not very long. But because of that short run time, they really need to make the best of these scenes.
Yeah.
They really don't, in my opinion. There's actually a review, if we want to skip ahead a little bit here. There was a review that exists of this from Mordaunt Hall of the New York Times. And he said, quote, as a film in which the direction, the direction, the photography, the microphone work, and the magnificent acting take precedence over the negligible story. And to me, I think that crushes it. Like, the story is negligible. And it does feel like it's kind of an afterthought. But everything else is firing, right? Like, the actors are performing very well. The set design is great. The film looks good. I also think we're kind of in, like, this is a weird year. Mm-hmm. Because I was telling someone else, All Quiet on the Western Front doesn't look like any of these other movies surrounding it.
Yeah, that's true.
So it does look like it's kind of the template setter for what's to come in the future. Mm-hmm. So the films that are winning and nominated look a little bit more like All Quiet on the Western Front, a little less like The Big House. So not that it's The Big House's fault, but there's a quality being done on something like the production of All Quiet on the Western Front that can't be matched. And I don't just mean in scale. I mean, like, the way that the camera is able to capture what it is. And maybe it's the Blu-ray cut that I have of All Quiet on the Western Front versus the Tubi cut of The Big House.
The Tubi cut. There's, I love that.
There's a real version of that.
Yeah.
Real chance of that. But overall, it just doesn't look the same. So that being said, it does still look good. It's just not quite to the standard of what has been set now with Lewis Milestone's All Quiet on the Western Front.
Interesting. I wonder, maybe All Quiet will be a detriment to your overall enjoyment of some of these movies to come.
Yeah, this movie was so great that I actually hated everything that came after. No, and I don't think that, and I definitely don't hate The Big House. It's more just kind of confounding, right? Like, it's not really fully baked is what it feels like. And to me, there is some good writing in there. I think the way that the prisoners talk to each other feels very authentic. That didn't feel forced. I do think that we could have had Wallace Beery not saying he's only kidding so many times, but that's neither here nor there. I do want to take a second to talk about Wallace Beery.
Okay.
Did you do any research on the role of Machine Gun?
The role of Machine Gun or Wallace Beery himself?
Well, I mean, Machine Gun is played by Wallace Beery.
Sure.
So the casting.
Yeah, I know a little bit about it.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
You think that's important to mention in a podcast where we love talking about certain things?
Yeah, hit me with it.
Okay, cool. So Wallace Beery wasn't originally slated to play Machine Gun Butch. He's a violent career criminal who rules the prison cell block. He was originally slated to be played by Lon Chaney. Did you know that?
I read it leading up to this episode and I forgot. So it's still, I wish I would have spit out my coffee.
Yeah, I should have told you 5 seconds earlier. That's my bad.
It's great for an audio podcast.
Well, they would have heard the take. So, but yeah, so Lon Chaney. And for those who may not have fully listened to the Hollywood Review of 1929, kind of a legend on this podcast now. We're worried about ever not catching enough sleep in case he's going to get his hands on us. I kind of wanted to see this.
Yeah.
Kind of want to see Lon Chaney play this role of a Machine Gun Butch. Unfortunately, it didn't work out that way just because the cancer that he had did take him in August 1930. So it already advanced too far. So Wallace Beery took the role here specifically, which is good because obviously that like catapulted Beery's career.
Yes.
This role and this nomination. So good for him. I mean, obviously, Lon Chaney's an established name at this point, so it's not like his career needed it, but obviously terrible that he was suffering from cancer. Yeah. So
and he passed away very shortly after.
Correct. That. Yeah. So
correct me if I'm wrong, too. Wallace Beery was with Paramount before this, and he was dropped by the studio. So he was kind of down and out, and he got cast by MGM for this role. And within 2 years of this movie coming out, he was the world's highest paid actor.
100%. Because of his performance here, how much of The Big House was a hit, and his nominations from this, that got him to that position within 2 years.
It's fascinating, because when I think of the highest paid actors just throughout history, I think of very handsome, like Hollywood starlets kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Wallace Beery is a very rough-looking guy.
Well, I think this is the trend, right? I mean, we talk about Lewis Wolheim, my future husband, and we talked about how he specifically has such like a burly nature to him.
It's true.
But he has like this like tender heart behind him.
Yeah.
So I think that that paved the way for someone like Butch to like a character like Butch to be as influential on the screen as possible. Because I think it's arguable that Kent and Morgan are kind of the leads of this.
Yes.
Right? Third lead would be Machine Gun. But Machine Gun is also, unfortunately, kind of seen as a little bit like a pawn. Like how Morgan can lead him or Kent can lead him, but he's not really leading himself. And by the end, he does, and we'll get to that. But he's kind of seen as like a little bit of a pawn, a loose cannon.
Yeah.
But he is absolutely, I think, the most magnetic thing on screen.
100%. Yeah, absolutely.
His performance. So with Lon Chaney, maybe we wouldn't have gotten that, right? But it is great to see that even in 1930, that one role can just kind of catapult you like this. One hit.
Yeah.
Can kind of take you to that point. So obviously this wasn't the only work that he did in that 2-year run. So there's more to speak to that.
No. Yeah. We actually will talk about him next year.
There you go.
It's pretty exciting.
Isn't that funny? That works out both ways. We're going to talk about it actually in 2026, but then it'll be covering another year. It's great how that works.
That's
out.
Why I like doing this order that we're doing.
Yeah. This helps out. So just want to bring that up about Lon Chaney. Thought that was very interesting based on everything we've talked about. yep. Worth noting that Kyle just did the stance from the musical.
Yep. that Lon Chaney was not in.
That he was absolutely no part in. God, I love that so much.
It is very good.
T-shirt incoming. So Morgan's back in prison. He's caught. Mm-hmm. He doesn't do anything wrong. He's just caught. They recognize him. They bring him back in. So now he's in prison. Kent hears about this and he is petrified.
Right, right.
Like, what, does he still think it was me? Mm-hmm. Machine Gun has kind of cleared this up. He's like, hey, man, it's fine. The other guy who was rooming with us, the guy who didn't speak English, he tried doing this to someone else. So it was him who did it. It couldn't have been Kent. And Morgan basically says, cool, whatever.
Yeah.
Like, just doesn't really respond to it.
I'm dead inside.
I'm dead inside.
I know I'm back stuck here. Whatever.
Exactly. So it's confirmed to Morgan, hey, welcome back. We are kind of staging a bit of a coup. We're going to take over the prison. It's going to happen at this point. And it's revealed to us that Kent has taken this time to be a canary and that he is now speaking to the warden about everything that he sees inside and hoping that this speaks to his good behavior and gets him off early. So this then takes us to our final sequence, which this coup does begin. I want to stop real quick and talk about probably my favorite shot scene in the movie.
Is it the gun exchange?
It's the gun exchange in the church. There's a church scene where everyone is kneeling and they're told to get on their knees to pray. Mm-hmm. And they do. But then down the line of one pew that includes Kent, Morgan, and Machine Gun, along with like maybe 10 other people, they're passing guns and exchanging guns to each other. So they're all armed. Mm-hmm. And that scene's pretty good, but it's not until they get to the bullets that you really see what's happening.
Yes.
And they're passing the bullets, maybe like 6 or so, maybe more, in a handful. And they're just passing hand to hand. Mm-hmm. And you already know what's coming, but the suspense of it is filmed so well that it completely hits when it does happen and a bullet drops.
It's so good.
The only downside of this scene, and it is very good, the only downside is that scene does not pay off. Because there is that little like ding. And again, something we couldn't do without sound.
Right.
The sound of the bullet hitting is just like such like a, it hits you. And you're like, oh my God, they're not going to get away with it.
Yes.
But no one notices.
But I think that's okay. I think this is the kind of shot that was replicated in movies like The Godfather.
Yeah.
Where it doesn't have to pay off. This is just a scene that is building tension.
Hmm.
And I'm okay with that. Like that's... It's a great scene. It's one of the most memorable scenes of the movie. And if it doesn't pay off, that's okay with me.
See, and I think you're right. For me, I would have wanted like literally 1 second more of like silence.
Sure.
Because there's a pastor who's speaking. So if they drop the bullet and they're getting up and they drop it and they all have a look at each other and there's like literally a beat of silence. I'm like, oh my God, what's going to happen? And the pastor kind of looks around. He's like, but the point of this is, and you're like,
yeah,
oh. There's like them speaking is that moment of you like breathing, mm-hmm. but it really is like pin drop. They look up and then he starts speaking immediately to where there isn't that beat of relief. Mm-hmm. So just one tiny little thing where I think that amazing scene would have had a bigger payoff of like, do I get the exhale scene and not just, oh, he didn't hear that. I heard that.
That's fair. And that might be an example of like this, this is the base level of these films to come.
But you can see what they're doing.
Right.
And this, you're right, Godfather, scenes to come, they do this. And it's done so well. Heist movies love to do this scene.
Yeah.
And it's done very well there, and this is the template. So it's very cool to see it kind of play out this way. And I love when you, the audience, can kind of get somewhere at the same time as the movie. Mm-hmm. And when you see the bullets come out, you're like, oh, I know exactly what we're doing.
Yeah.
And that rocks. So it was very, very cool. Love that scene. And then that leads to the prison breakout, the riot within the prison. So we won't have to go into all the details, but essentially the roles that are played here is that Machine Gun takes the lead. Machine Gun is not afraid to take the said machine gun and fire willingly at whoever is on the other end of it.
He's got a Tommy gun. He's going nuts.
Yep. They've captured a few officers and they've put them and some of the other prisoners in a cell. And it isn't until Kent kind of decides that he doesn't want to do this. He's having a mental breakdown. He thought he could be involved in this. He thought he can get out with good behavior if he just ratted on everybody. But now he's directly in the line of fire.
Yeah.
He panics. He runs out. He actually gets shot and dies. So he dies in a panic. And now it's down to Kent and, or I'm sorry, Morgan and Machine Gun. And Machine Gun has kind of lost his mind a little bit here and has fully bought into the idea that if there is a rat amongst them, and it is confirmed that it was Kent,
right,
that it has to be Morgan.
Yes.
And that Morgan has outed him.
Yeah. And that kind of leads to the ending of their friendship. He's hunting him down. He's like, I'm not going to get out of here alive, so I'm going to go take out Morgan. He's hunting him down. Morgan, at this point, is really trying to put a stop to the whole riot.
Right.
He's taken it upon himself to save prisoners and guards alike, just kind of out of the kindness of his heart, I think.
Well, I think he forgot. You know, it's easy to forget when you're in prison, there's another life outside of it. And when he escaped, he was able to witness that life again and like see that there was a possibility.
Yeah.
So if there's a chance to get back to that, he wants to, but he's watching everyone throw their lives away and not obtain that again.
It is interesting that he's not only is he saying, if I'm on my best behavior, maybe I can get out again. He's like, I'm going to be on my ultra best behavior.
Yeah.
I'm going to start saving people. I'm going to Pee Wee Herman out of here with like all the snakes in my hand and stuff. But yeah, Butch tracks him down and there's a great standoff between the two where they end up shooting each other. Only Butch gets hit, right? Is that correct?
Correct. Well, no. Butch gets hit and then Morgan gets hit in the arm.
Okay, he does get shot.
Because he has a sling.
Yes. So they're both hit and they kind of like crawl towards each other.
Yeah.
To say their farewells. And Morgan reveals like, hey, I'm not the rat. Not that it really matters anymore. And they say their friendly, weird kind of goodbye.
Is it touching? It's a goodbye.
Yeah,
it was touching.
No, I mean, it's definitely a goodbye, but it's...
It felt kind of like the difference of like when a dog is seeing red and it kind of bites your hand.
Mm.
And like the conversation you have afterwards where you're like, you see what you did here. And they're like, yeah, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Like it's that because you can kind of see Machine Gun coming down from it.
Yeah.
And Morgan still has that affinity for him because of what they've been through. So he knows, I think he's always known he was a mad dog and he just let him loose. And in this case... He just got bit, and I don't think he even held it against him. But it's funny, because there is a moment where an officer kind of, like, shouts out to Butch, where he's like, hey, it's not Morgan. Kent did it. Like, it's I'm confirming to you that it was Kent. And Machine Gun's like, yeah, but just in case. Like, in case you're not right. Again, he's seeing red. He can't listen to this. So I thought it was nice. I'm not going to say it was a tearjerker, but I thought it was a nice reflection of who Morgan was. That he was willing to overlook being shot at because he knows this person in and out.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I think it kind of to argue your point about how the characters are not really.
It's better at the end.
It is. Yeah. And I think this movie benefits from a second watch.
Okay.
Because you, at this point, you know who these characters are and you can kind of see why they make the decisions they do throughout the movie and kind of where their morality leads them. As that morality kind of shifts based on what's going on. Morgan's close to parole. He's going to behave a certain way. He just found out Kent's a little weasel. He's going to behave a lot different in that moment. So I really like the way the characters are presented in this overall. But we'll wrap up the movie. Because of Morgan's heroics by the end of this film, turns out he gets off. He's set free. He saves so many prisoners and not soldiers,
security guards. Yeah.
Yeah. During this heroic act where tanks show up, it's a wild end battle.
The tank was, I did not expect that. They said send the tanks in. I was like, okay. And then there's like an actual tank that's just trying to ram the door.
Yes.
Kind of insane production.
It's intense. Yeah. There's a lot of people die. The warden has a crazy moment in this final battle where they're like, hey, they've got like 50 guards in there. What do we do? And he's like,
gas them.
Wipe them out. But
yeah, the warden didn't care.
No, he did not.
But another reason why, like, in my eyes, if they send the tank in there and he's like, gas him, I don't care. If there's even security guards in there, I don't buy that they're giving him this Medal of Freedom and letting him go. I think that they're killing the prisoners or sending them back in and be like, get out of here, stop it. So that was a little confusing if the warden was the one to send that message in, but then ultimately awards Kent or Morgan the ability to go home.
I do think the warden is kind of a confusing character. We didn't talk about him much. He's played by Lewis Stone. Mm-hmm. And when you first meet him, he's kind of hopeful towards the prisoners.
Because he talks about the current state of prisons and how overpacked they are.
He's like, look, things are rough in here. If you're a bad guy, that's going to come out in prison. It pushes you to be who you truly are. Mm-hmm. And I like that message because it kind of backs up how he treats Morgan at the end.
Yes.
Oh, he was pushed to the brink. He was in a really bad spot and he played heroics by the end. Mm-hmm. Cool. But he also says, oh, there's a bunch of guards in there. I don't care. Kill whoever you got
to
kill.
We're you not did issue to kill your own people.
Yes.
Yeah. That to me is like, I agree if that scene didn't exist of him just like send the tanks in there and blow everybody away.
Yes.
Then the morality that he believes in makes sense.
But maybe.
Totally.
Maybe that's what it is. Maybe Morgan did such good at that final battle that it saved a bunch of people's lives that he was about to be the cause of, the warden.
Yeah.
So he's like, you kind of saved my skin a little bit there, dude.
To your point, a longer movie would have had that scene where the warden storms in there and the security guards, again, who were just ordered to be killed by him, were like, no, warden, you don't understand. This guy saved us. So like you kind of see his change and like, oh, I misjudged you.
Yeah.
Like something. But it feels like there's like something on the cutting room floor or something missing. Mm-hmm. And maybe that's what it is. Because the acting is good, but it just feels kind of incoherent at times.
Yes.
So it feels like there's scenes that we're supposed to infer that isn't like an inferred idea. Because there's a character piece that kind of pushes against that idea before. So that's where my frustration is a little bit with this movie. But I agree with you that the best work that's done in this is between Morgan and Machine Gun, because their relationship kind of like that makes the perfect sense for them to have that crawl to moment of like apologies to each other.
Yeah.
So I liked that a lot. The final bit, actually the final scene of the movie too, but the final bit that also kind of confused me is that we established that Morgan was very interested in Anne, who happens to be Kent's sister.
Yes.
At the very end of the movie, when he gets out, Anne actually meets him and picks him up from the airport and gleefully hugs him. Girl, your brother died. Like, your brother died brutally in this, like, prison riot.
Which, it does make me wonder, speaking on the warden's words originally, if prison brings out the true nature of who you are and all of that, if you're a bad guy, you'll see it. Maybe because we see that Kent was kind of a weasel, maybe that's who he was in real life as well. Just because they're sister and brothers doesn't mean that they have an affection for each other.
Then why'd she have to visit him?
You feel obligated. You know, I don't know.
But see, these are the things where, like, if there's a conversation where she's like, my brother, whatever, cool. Mm-hmm. There isn't really. Like, no. She's like, well, you know, my brother got this bad beat. It was said that he was an accident, right? Yeah. Like, he didn't do it intentionally. To a point where Machine Gun's like, you're not real, like, heavy. Like, he heard he killed someone. He's like, oh, yeah, my kind of guy.
Yeah.
He's like, oh, you did accidentally? Get out of here, you weasel. So, it's not, to your point, it's not insane to assume these things, but there isn't anything put in there to kind of make you get to that point.
You're right. I do hate having to make assumptions for a story and be like, well, this is probably the lore behind it.
Especially when it's a Best Picture nominee.
Yes.
Right? Like, you look at the competition that you have, and I'm not talking just about All Quiet on the Western Front. Mm-hmm. I'm talking about, like, you know, Disraeli, for as painstakingly, you know, set up as it is, there is logic behind, like, why all of that is happening.
Yeah.
Divorcee, that is presented with, like, logic. So there's a standard that's being set that I think The Big House ultimately lends itself and is the blueprint to movies like Shawshank Redemption that do solidify this and become classics in their own right. But I don't think that this one had all of those pieces together.
So the interesting thing there is you brought up four different movies, mm-hmm. all of which were based on pre-existing material. So there is that.
Yeah.
Shawshank, Stephen King, mm-hmm. You know, the others were all based on books as well. The Divorcee, All Quiet, and Disraeli based on true events.
So and also, I believe, 300 other performances by the same actor.
Fair play. This, we didn't spit any praise for Francis Marion, who wrote this screenplay.
True.
And major props to her. And I want to emphasize the her there. She was the first woman nominated in a non-screen role. So obviously we have our best actresses and things like that, but this is the first woman to receive a nomination.
Very cool that it only took 3 years.
It is cool. It is cool. It's sad that it hasn't happened more frequently.
You'll hear more. I think we had heard something recently about best actress or best supporting actress, and there was a diversity in there that hadn't been acknowledged yet. And we're well into almost 100 years of the Academy at that point. Mm-hmm. So to your point, very, very, very cool. And I don't want to say awesome, but just very progressive and a good direction that it only took 3 years to get to this point.
Absolutely.
Also, not the last time we'll talk about her.
No. Very soon, I believe The Champ, which also stars Wallace Beery.
Also next episode.
Oh, yeah. The Ceremony episode?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Yeah. We'll talk about her then.
Totally.
I'm very excited for that.
It'll be very cool. I do want to point out, Frances Marion was married to the director, George Hill.
Oh.
So it's kind of cool to think she wrote this story, and then her husband was like, that's incredible.
Let me direct it.
Babe, yeah, let's do this.
I feel like that's every conversation between a writer and a director. It's just like, good job, babe.
Yeah.
Let me take care of that for you.
100%. So that's The Big House. You know, there's the whole beat-by-beat plot. To get into the nitty-gritty, right? I don't think you like this story as much as I like this story.
I think the story is good. I think that the connective tissue mm-hmm. of why the characters make the decisions that they made is not super clear in the movie.
I would agree with that. I do think this was my second time watching this movie.
Sure.
I did it for the first run. I mentioned I think this is better a second time through because you do know where everybody ends up, not just physically, but from a moral standpoint as well. And it gives you a better idea of why they make the decisions they do. Obviously, you shouldn't have to watch a movie twice to really get the full benefit of it.
It only helps.
Right.
Yeah.
But I'm forgiving of the omissions of, hey, why is this guy doing that? The biggest qualm I have with it is Morgan and Anne and their super light speed advance of their romance.
Yes.
It doesn't make any kind of sense to me. It did require another 30 minutes at least of them having a great life together for, I don't know, a week maybe. Yeah. But overall, I really enjoy the story. I think that the dialogue at times is very strong. I love the personalities that are formed based off of the dialogue. And I think a lot of praise is in order for Frances Marion and the way that she wrote this film.
Yeah.
It does have holes and it needs those filled.
Sure.
I agree with you.
Well, I mean, but that's the thing is that it doesn't make a bad movie, right? Like it is still very effective. You understand the final scenes and where we are. I think the most jarring for me is just going to be Kent and just his overall journey because he's not introduced as like a rat or, you know, like introduced as like a terrible person. Mm-hmm. He realizes that he does need the good behavior to get by. And with him already doing what he did to Morgan, it makes sense that he kind of has to feel an obligation to the warden to rat people out and let them know when things are happening.
Yeah.
So the idea of like turning against your brothers in there, that's something we'll talk about here in a second. But I think that the movie does a really good job of showing the brotherhood that you can make within a system like that.
Mm-hmm.
Just to dial back a little bit here, when we talk about production, you talked about the matte paintings, the backdrops. And that is great. And obviously, you know, there's a lot of set pieces to this. One of my favorites is actually the first time that they're taking Kent up into his room. You see that they've actually built out 3 layers of stairs and cells.
Yes.
And you just see them kind of like slowly, I guess, just like walk up the stairs. Mm-hmm. And there's just something about it where it's like almost like a black backdrop, where it's almost like they just set this up in a void.
Mm-hmm.
And that again lends to the German expressionism we talked about with the alibi. And I loved this scene. Something just like it's dumb in 2025 to be like, wow, they built all that. Of course they did. They had to. But it's very cool to see those things built out. There's a scene later on, actually during the prison riot scene, where there's a lot of people climbing up and down those stairs. And you see the structural integrity of this to where they have hundreds of people like climbing in and out and running out of those doors. And that's all there. So I loved this scene. And there's a couple scenes like that. And the tension of the church scene with the bullets, that to me was just kind of like, this is great. Like this should be so much better. And then a tank shows up and I was like, what's going on? So I don't think the character work is 100% on this, but it is still very much like in the top tier of the movies that we've watched for this for me mm-hmm. in terms of enjoyment level. Had a good time with it. I do like the character of Kent and Morgan, even if they aren't fully fleshed out. Morgan a little bit more than Kent, but obviously the story wants you to kind of sympathize a little more with Morgan than with Kent.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Okay. I thought you said it the other way. I was like, wait a minute.
No, absolutely not.
Yeah, you're right.
Kent is essentially like a scared little boy who dies in the mud.
Yes.
Is his character work, more or less.
Absolutely. To shout out the art direction, as you were just talking about, this was Cedric Gibbons. We've talked about numerous times now.
Oh, sure.
Yeah. It's kind of fun to think that whenever you talk about a film from a certain studio, you have an idea of who's going to be running different departments. Cedric Gibbons, Douglas Shearer. These are names we've mentioned in the past and names that we get to continue to mention kind of every time there's a nominee from that studio.
Right.
I'm a big fan of that. We didn't talk a whole lot about Chester Morris. Again, he wasn't nominated for this role, but this is now the third time that we've seen him.
Why do you think that is?
Why was he not nominated?
I think I understand why he wasn't nominated, because of any performance in this, it's Machine Gun's role.
Yeah.
But no, I meant more so, why do you think we're seeing him pop up so many times?
I think he's handsome.
He is handsome.
I think he's a good actor.
Great jawline.
Yeah, really good jawline. He was really doing well for this time. I think he has a voice that is almost iconic for the era. When I think about the 1930s, the late 1920s, and that like transatlantic kind of dialect, he's doing exactly what I imagine. So when they do the switch from silent to sound, with that voice, he must have just been a shoo-in for, oh, this guy's handsome, he sounds great, cast him. And this is now the second time that he's played kind of a criminal, a gangster type. I think he plays that role really well.
Is it weird to say, I think he performed a bit better as Chick Williams in Alibi than he did in this? And maybe that's just the character connective tissue missing for me, but I remember him with more fondness as Chick than I do here.
Yeah.
Although maybe. I think he's more sympathetic in this movie.
Yes. That might be what it is. I mean, he was nominated in Alibi.
Correct.
So there is that. He was doing, like we talked about, the kind of multiple levels of Chick. He was scared. He was smug. You get a little bit less of that in this movie. It's still a great performance. I think his romance with Anne kind of detracts from the overall performance. And it might be, too, that you're so focused on Wallace Beery that he gets outshined. Chester Morris does.
True. That makes sense. And also, it's difficult to have any kind of connective emotion with Ted, his performance as Ted in The Divorcee.
Yes.
Mostly because he looks at Norma Shearer and says, not enough.
Yeah, not interested.
Couldn't believe that. The whole premise of that movie, when he's like, yeah, I cheated on you, I'm like, and movie over.
Right. Dropped the ball, Ted. It is pretty wild.
But that being said, all kidding aside, he does play the transformation of a divorced husband to like alcoholic very well. Like you see that portrayal done very well for him.
Yeah.
And everything makes sense as to why he's performing the way he is. So great job. I really do like him in that. But there's something about Chick Williams versus this. And I think it's not his fault. I think it's the movie's fault. Whether that's direction or something missing in the script, I don't know. But there's something not present there. And to your point, there might have been scenes that were filmed like this that actually do kind of like fill in the gaps. Because it does feel like they're gaps, right? It's not people acting one way and acting another at a different time. You just don't understand why they're doing this.
Right.
So I feel like there's some connective tissue missing. That's the big term for me on this one.
Yeah, and we're still in an era where the studios...
Sure, they're figuring it out.
Well, not only are they figuring it out, but they are very much in charge. So I could very, very much see them being like, all right, this is a great idea for a movie. Cut 45 minutes from it.
Yep.
Who's to say? So Wallace Beery, we talked about him quite a bit. He's going to be making a return in quite a few movies, but specifically... Whoops. We'll be seeing him in The Champ, which was, like I said, also written by Francis Marion. So I said this earlier, I really like that we're going in order of all these years, and this is a huge reason why I'm enjoying doing it. You get to see, oh, this is the first time Francis Marion was nominated.
Mm-hmm.
She will return. Like, every episode kind of ends with a...
MCU post.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I'm all for it. So I'm excited for that. Lewis Stone, who played the warden, will be back. We'll see him in a bigger role in Grand Hotel.
I actually see Wallace Beery back in Grand Hotel as well.
Oh my goodness. Highest paid actor.
There's a reason.
Makes sense. Layla, Hyams?
I was looking forward for you to say the name.
Hyams?
Hyams.
Layla Hyams.
H-A-Y. No, H-Y-A-M-S.
Yes.
Yeah.
She played Venus in Todd Browning's Freaks.
Really?
Yeah.
Huh.
Which I just recently watched Freaks for the first time. So when I saw her in this, I was like, you look familiar. But it's been a long time since I've seen The Big House. It was Freaks.
Wow. So. I confused Freaks with Freaked at first, the Alex Winter film.
Oh.
Yeah. It's a bit different.
That's a long ways away.
It's a long ways away. Yeah. It's, I was about to say, very cool that it just got a release on a Shout or Umbrella. And that's not Freaks.
That's not Freaks.
Freaks got a Criterion release, didn't it?
Did it?
Maybe not.
It may have. I
don't know. It definitely got a release, but it may have been from like Shout or Umbrella or Arrow, someone. Yeah. But I wanted to say it was Criterion. I felt like I could see the cover on a big C with a Criterion.
Could be.
I'll get back to you on that.
Speaking of physical releases,
yeah,
Warner Archive released a DVD.
My guys.
In 2014.
Very cool.
Yeah. So it includes alternate foreign language cuts of the movie,
which is something that they did do. They did do specific foreign language versions. Mm-hmm. That wasn't too atypical, right? In the early days of like sound films.
No. I mean, that's how you got the Spanish version of Dracula.
Yeah.
Which a lot of people claim is scarier than the Bela Lugosi version.
Wow.
I've not seen it. But I would like to sit down and watch the foreign cuts of this, specifically because I wonder if some of that material, the holes we're talking about, exist in any way.
That's true. I did just type in the foreign language versions, and I found exactly what you're talking about. So the French and Spanish versions are available with the original in a triple feature set from the Warner Archives.
Yeah.
Interesting that they made a set, but it was the same movie three times in different languages.
Yes.
But, I mean, again, great work by Warner Archives.
Yeah. I've been doing some research on physical media for all of these movies we've been covering.
Oh, my guy.
Most of them are available in some format. And Warner Archive does a lot.
Well, here's the thing. Were available.
Yeah.
I'll say. Yeah. You know, obviously not in print. And you'd have to find someone who had it or, like, sold it. Yeah. So, a little difficult to get your hands on. I don't fully expect Warner Archives to be releasing this triple feature, you know, production-wise and manufacturing year in, year out.
Sure.
But it's not something that we can go to the store and pick up now.
No. Check eBay.
Check eBay.
Or, you know, you might get lucky and find something at McKay's.
Go to your garage sales.
Yeah.
You never know what people have.
I told you I went to a yard sale fairly recently and I saw a collection of Cisco Kid movies.
That's so cool.
Isn't it?
I feel like every time I go, there's always like, I have 17 versions of Lego Dimensions on PS3.
Yes.
Like, thanks.
And here's three copies of Titanic on VHS.
Yeah.
And you're like, I don't have that yet. I'll take two.
I don't need 9 VHSs.
Yeah, there is that. So let's get into ratings.
Yes. So I think I'm interested to hear where you are on this because I think that you clocked that I wasn't as thrilled with this. Something that I've been doing too is when I'm watching these movies, I go into my letterbox and I actually just mark it as reviewed, but I don't want to put a rating.
Mm-hmm.
I put a rating pretty quickly if I'm confident with it when I see movies in theaters. But when we're covering things here, if anyone's following me on Letterbox, I don't really want to give it away too much. So I think I'm going to wait until the episode releases.
It's a good call
to start putting that review out. So Bryce, you can't go in there and see what I put. Sorry, buddy. Anyone else? I don't think they're looking that hard. But so with this, I still very much enjoyed the direction for the most part. You brought up the matte painting. Mm. Beautiful. I think that lent itself to the scale of the film. Love the production side of it. And I ultimately thought that the tension of that scene in the church and the prison riot scene was enough to just have me interested in this movie. So solid 3 stars for
nice.
Me, okay. For The Big House.
Very cool. Very cool. I really like this movie. This is one that I would put on just out of nowhere.
Yeah. Not even for research.
No. Yeah. It's an enjoyable movie. I like all of the performances. I gave it 4 stars.
Wow.
Which is pretty high.
Pretty high.
I think I've only given out one rating higher than that.
And that was the last episode.
Yeah. So I don't know what it is about this movie. Maybe I just like prison movies.
Maybe.
Who knows?
Great subgenre. And all the more important why this exists, because it really is kind of the grandfather of them.
Yeah.
It's not the first to ever do it, but it is the first to do it on this scale.
Yeah. And when you're talking about Wallace Beery being the highest paid actor after this, it was nominated for Best Picture, all of these things goes to show, yeah, maybe this wasn't the first, but it is so important to the history of this subgenre.
Sure.
So, Shawshank, you're welcome. You know?
You're welcome, Stephen King.
Yeah.
I would like to hear if they got any inspirations from this. Like, if anyone saw this and was like, yeah, I made my assault on Precinct 13 because of this movie.
Yeah. I don't know what John Carpenter watches.
I'm not sure John Carpenter knows what John Carpenter watches.
John Carpenter just plays Dead Space a lot.
And God bless him. He's doing the work. And if his love and advocacy for Dead Space results in us getting a John Carpenter-produced Dead Space movie, hell, let's do it. I'd love to see it.
Mm-hmm. We won't.
A dream of mine. It won't happen, but it is a dream of mine. So I mentioned something in our coverage here, and that was the brotherhood aspect of this, and the idea of entering this prison. And for the most part, we didn't really talk about it. Maybe it was a sign of the times in 1930. Entering a prison here was like shopping in 2025, where you're just like, hey, I'm here for the prison. They're like, yeah, sure thing, man. Give me your stuff. Cigarettes? You can have that back. Don't worry about that. Picture of your sister? That's all yours, buddy. But I'll hold on to this stuff, and you can get it back when you leave. Like, okay. And everyone you talk to is just like, yeah, you know what? Do your best in there, and we'll figure it out. Not a big deal. This is not like, you know, a world of being punished or whatever, but it really was just kind of like a chill, oh, I enjoyed my time in prison. You know, that kind of thing. So, that aside, the real story behind it for me was the brotherhood and the connection that you make here. So even though you are all criminals, you are kind of looking out for one another in a sense of like, hey, if you're going to rat, then like we're going to kill you because we're all just trying to like get along here, whether it's we're breaking out or we're just trying to form these like meaningful relationships. And maybe we're ribbing you every once in a while, tricking you, thinking you're leaving early, but you're not. But ultimately, like, you're looking out for each other. Mm-hmm. And the idea of crime and brotherhood to me really reminded me of Ben Affleck's The Town.
Okay.
So, for me...
we continue the trend of movies I've not seen.
Hey, you really should see The Town.
I should.
The Town was the first movie that Taylor and I saw together.
Oh, wow. Romantic. Yeah,
we went... she was like, that's Jennifer Lopez's husband. we went to Starlight Drive-In in Atlanta.
Oh, very cool.
Loved it. Yeah. So we got to see The Town in a drive-in. It was very cool. And also, I just love a heist movie. Mm. And this is a great heist movie where they really let you like feel for the criminals. Mm-hmm. But you're seeing both sides. It's akin to Heat in that sense where it doesn't shy away from like letting you spend time with both the... I guess, depending on how you look at it, the good and the bad side of this crime, right? You kind of learn to love or hate, depending on how you feel, these people. And they let you choose from there. Something that I think this movie does, good or bad, where it kind of makes you choose how you feel about these people, because it's not going to tell you up front, or even in the middle. At the end, it will. But it doesn't tell you how to feel about them. It kind of lets you decide. I think it's a little frustrating in this, whereas in The Town, it's a little bit more like, hey, we're going to tell you them fully fleshed out, and it's your decision how you feel about them.
Sure.
In Big House, it feels a little bit less like, it's less that, and it's more, we're not giving you all the details, and I'm interested in what you think about that.
I like it.
Doesn't work so much for me. But the brotherhood aspect, the crime aspect, not a lot of prison time shown in this in The Town, very little. But it is more about the brotherhood and crime, which I thought stood out to The Big House. So a good double feature in that sense for me. Also, one of the last times we saw Pete Postlethwaite, and I think he's fantastic in that movie. So, The Town.
Very good.
You need to see that movie.
I do. I'm falling behind on my Affleck filmography.
Have you caught up on You're Invited to Mary Kate and Ashley Olsen's Sleepover?
You know, I have to watch one of those like every year, because otherwise I think I get put on a list.
Have to is a great word, yeah.
You know?
Well, first off, it's not the list that you think it is. no. It's actually my Christmas card list, is whoever watches right. those movies. Hello, brother, I see you.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
I become the Tom Cruise cake list. I fit onto that.
That is my Tom Cruise cake list. Good call. Yeah.
So, I remembered my double feature.
Good.
I almost forgot what it's called. I remembered my thing. I'm going to go with a connection to the relationship between Morgan and Butch.
Sure.
I feel like Morgan is kind of looking out for Butch in whatever way Morgan is allowed to look out for Butch. Butch is kind of like infantilized.
A little bit.
He's very, hey, Butch, why'd you do that? Who, me?
Who, me?
Yeah.
Who, me and I'm kidding are the two things his catchphrases. You pulled the string on his back on his toy. Those are the two
phrases. Exactly. And Morgan is very much the guy in charge. A similar relationship to that of George and Lenny from Of Mice and Men.
Yeah.
Which I'm double featuring the 1992 Gary Sinise directed version of that.
The superior.
It's the only one I've seen. Another cool twist, though, the 1939 version. In these roles, I imagine Wallace Beery would be Lenny, right?
Oh, of course.
Who do you think played Lenny in the 1939
version? Shut up. Really?
Who do you think it was?
Lewis Beery? Wilhelm?
Lon Chaney Jr.
Oh my God, how crazy.
Plot twist.
Wow.
Isn't that great? So that's my pick. They're also kind of on the run in Of Mice and Men, at least
yes.
Lenny is.
Yeah, yeah,
so
yeah.
There is that, you know, element of it as well.
That's a great call.
I do think the relationship between the two is kind of similar, though.
See, and that's what's interesting to me is that you're dead on. That's a perfect casting, a perfect comparison. But in perfect The Big House fashion, it kind of forgets about Kent.
Yeah.
So, like, Kent, who is the first character we're introduced to, and kind of introduces, like, the lead, but, like, ultimately isn't. Perfect representation of The Big House.
Maybe Kent is curly.
Sure.
He's kind of annoying in that.
Yeah.
Of Mice and Men.
I mean,
he's really annoying.
But a further point, or further evidence that it really is Morgan and mostly Machine Gun's movie.
Sherilyn Fenn plays Curly's wife in that movie.
Really?
That's Audrey Horne. From Twin Peaks.
Oh.
I'm rewatching that movie tonight. Love Twin Peaks. But yeah, there you go. Those are double features and our ratings. And this is a long episode.
Don't be afraid to check out our Letterboxd. We officially have a Letterboxd now for Once Upon a Time in the Oscars. And one of my favorite things that Kyle has done is that he is pairing our double features on separate lists. So make sure you check that out. Because if you ever think, wow, I haven't seen that movie before, now you can find it on Letterboxd, watch it yourself, rate it, keep track of what we're talking about here.
Yeah, give us a follow there. It's OUTAO Podcast, which is also the name we use on our Patreon.
Mm-hmm.
So if you want to vote on which movie you think deserved the Best Picture win for this final year of this season of the podcast, do so by going to patreon.com/OUTAO Podcast. And this is your last chance to get any emails in if you want to discuss the movies that we've covered, your overall feelings of the show, anything at all. We will be reading those on the final episode on New Year's Eve, OUTAOpodcast@gmail.com.
Get them in. We'll cover them on the ceremony episode.
Yep.
And give you one last send-off for 2025 before we come back strong in 2026 talking about the current year of Oscars and their nominees.
Very excited for that. We'll talk more about the specific details of that next episode.
Yep.
But that's going to do it, I think. So thanks as always for listening. I'm your host, Kyle.
And I'm Prisoner 48624.
And we'll
see you at the movies.